Well, this is my third time going through this today, so hopefully I've got it right finally. It's either that or third strike and I'm out, but we're going to give a good effort this afternoon, and I recognize the challenge I face because we just all had lunch, haven't we? There's the challenge. Well, our topic is a good one. I thought, how clever of the Southern Union to create this title, In Time, End Time. It's just a clever use of words. And the more I thought about that, the more intrigued I got. So they asked me for a title for my seminar, and I decided to play a game with their seminar for their overall weekend theme. So to the overall theme of In Time, End Time, I have chosen to entitle this presentation Just In Time, because I think we're going to find out that's just about where we are. Let me begin by just sharing with you some very recent news items. Here is a clipping from the Washington Times, which I got up in Washington just yesterday, March 11, 2005. There's a picture, those of you near the front can see it, of some ladies out publicly praying in Annapolis, Maryland. Their concern is about a pending bill, apparently, in Maryland regarding same-sex marriage. They feel very concerned about that. One of the ladies, the Caucasian lady there, has got her hands in the air. She is really praying. Her eyes are closed. She's very intense. The African-American lady below her looks equally intense. Very concerned people praying over an issue that deeply involves their personal moral values. Now, you think about that issue. It illustrates some of the challenges we face in America today. Most of us in this room probably would find ourselves in agreement with those praying ladies as to the underlying issue. I strongly believe in the traditional marriage that we have always held to be representative of marriage. I love my wife. She's a little ill right now. I pray for her every day and many times a day. So philosophically, I agree with these ladies who are out praying in front of the State House at Annapolis. But the question I want to pose to you as we begin that helps us understand the challenges America faces today is this. From what do they derive their religious conviction that marriage ought to be between a man and a woman? Where does that come from? It comes from the Bible. That's right. And my conviction on that thing comes from the Bible. It comes from Eden. You know, I go back to where it all began, and I see the Lord making Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, you know. So it seems pretty clear to me, from a religious perspective, where my convictions lie. But here is the challenge. Do I have the right to impose my religious convictions through the legislature on other people? There's the challenge we face. Is it possible for good people, meaning only good for this country, wanting a moral society and a safe neighborhood and decent schools and a future for their kids, is it possible for good people like that to inadvertently, unintentionally make mistakes? Well, let me give you issue number two. This one comes from out on the West Coast. Here is a picture of a Latino gangster. Those up close can see that there's a tattoo procedure in progress here. This man's covered with gang tattoo symbols. Okay? Now, let's talk about gangs very briefly, just because they illustrate the point. Back in the 1970s, 30, 35 years ago, gangs were around, but there weren't that many of them. I mean, they were maybe in 200 cities. They were, you know, they were there in the larger cities. Now we're discovering that gangs exist in 3,300 cities across America. You take any town with 250,000 or more people, and you're going to find gangs there. More than this, they've gone global. And an illustration of that is the fact that recently down in Honduras, members of a well-known gang called MS-13 met with Adnan Al-Shukri Juma, who is a major Al-Qaeda operative. The purpose of their meeting was for the gangs to work with Al-Qaeda and smuggle terrorists into the United States across the border. Now, what's the issue there? We are entering a strange new era in which America faces live or die challenges. And when America faces challenges like that, what happens? The vice jaws begin to come shut, because a country, like a living organism, like an animal, will do anything to survive, including reduce personal liberty. Our topic this afternoon is just in time. Now let's open the book. I invite you to join me in Revelation chapter 13. Revelation 13, and let's look first at verse 16. Revelation 13, 16. Very familiar passage there, a prophetic passage of something that will happen at or near the end of time. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark, and that none might what? Buy or sell, save he that hath the name, the mark, or the number. Now, in modern terminology, this thing that John looks at from the first century and describes, in modern terminology, what would we call this? It's an economic embargo. That name sound familiar? That's exactly what we do today, what the majority in the world does when they find a nation or a minority which, for some reason, frightens or presents a problem for the majority. The first thing we do is an economic embargo. Let's try to bring them into line through economic suasion. But you notice in Revelation 13, that's not all that John describes. Now back up to the 15th verse. And what does that say? Something about an image to the beast, and cause that as many as would not what? Worship the image shall be killed. That's lethal force. That's a death decree. So John describes something where, first of all, there's economic pressure put on in the form of an economic embargo. If that does not bring the nonconformist into line, you escalate things to the point where you're willing to use lethal force. Does any of that sound familiar? That's the world we're living in. Don't tell me this book is out of touch with modern times. All right. Now, what John describes then is a catastrophic disruption of liberty. So it's a time in the world in which liberty just disappears from human life. And the issue is religion. How do we know? Worship. Exactly right. The 15th verse uses that word worship, which automatically extends this threat sector now to something having to do with religion. Let me ask you a question. Can religion ever be dangerous? Let me read you something from Brent Scowcroft. You've heard of him, right? Scowcroft was kind of looking at the posture America is beginning to assume in the world and the motives that drive us. And he expressed his concern this way. These are his words. If you believe you are pursuing absolute good, then it is a sin to depart from it. Isn't it ironic that that same motivation is now driving both Al-Qaeda and, in a very polar opposite extent, some of our own convictions in this country, as the religious right begins to develop more and more a religious basis for where they think the country should go? Anytime you think you're pursuing absolute good, it's a sin to depart from it. Now, that leads to the second threat, the second problem that Scowcroft noted. He put it this way. The problem with absolutist beliefs is that they can get you into traps in which the ends justify the means. And there's the risk you run. What Revelation 13 is describing is a global religious conflict. And ladies and gentlemen, that's where we are right now. I don't care how much the politicians try to put a politically correct spin on this thing. This business of terrorism, of us versus them, is now a global religious conflict. Let me read it to you from a Syrian. He is a professor of religion at Harvard University. He is a Muslim. He was born in Syria. He is one of the world's recognized authorities in Islamic fundamentalist, and here's what he says is going on. These are his words. The goal of Islamic fundamentalists is to abolish the Western secular world order and replace it with a new Islamist divine order. The goal is a new imperial absolute Islamic world power. End of quote. That's what we're facing. Now, before we go on, let me ask you a question. Is Islam going to win that war? No, they won't. How do we know? Can you think of a text that just tells us for sure that how this thing is going to turn out? Revelation 13 certainly does suggest it. Yes, I can think of one in the words of Jesus when he predicts an end time event. He says, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached where? Everywhere except the Islamic world? Nope. He says everywhere. Now why? Because there are 1 billion Muslims in this world and the Lord loves them. And they deserve to hear the gospel, don't they? And as earth accelerates toward this terminal event that's going to call the time of trouble such as never was, requiring an intervention, a cosmic rescue called the coming of Jesus, the entire living generation of humans on the world, over 6 billion of them, have to make decisions. Am I going to do this or this? And the decision they make determines whether they live or die forever. Pretty important stakes, aren't they? So these people deserve to hear the gospel. It's a due process issue. You don't condemn somebody to die unless they've had a chance to see the issues, right? Oh, by the way, let me toss one other thought in here. How are they going to see the gospel? How is the gospel going to get preached to them? How do you preach it most effectively? Maybe that's the better question. Pardon? Television, one-to-one. But ultimately, the best way to preach the gospel is what? Live it. You preach it and you don't live it, and you've done more harm than good, haven't you? And what does Revelation 14 say? Here are they that preach the commandments of God and here are they that keep them. Now, I mention this just in passing, just tangentially, because wouldn't it be a terrible shame? That is our end time mission, one of them, to preach the commandments of God by living them. What if we as Adventists came to a time of discouragement when the Lord's coming had tarried and we don't know why he hasn't come and things aren't like they used to be and the country isn't as comfortable as it used to be and we're getting kind of tired and besides that we've proved we can't overcome because we just keep failing. So we have to deal with that disconnect. We have to deal with that tension. We do it by adopting a theology that says, wait a second, we've been too narrow-minded on this thing. Sin is very natural. It's part of being human. And we're going to go right on sinning till Jesus comes. What if we came to that conclusion? If we do it, we have no way of delivering the message. The Lord describes being delivered in Revelation 14:12. So anyway, it's clear that Islam isn't going to win this thing. Revelation 13 makes it clear that the winner will be some kind of religious power, but that superficial religiosity is going to bring on a time of trouble such as the world has never seen. And the process of winning, Christianity will surrender liberty and become intolerant of nonconformists. All right, let me ask a question. And let me introduce it this way. You know, the statement has been wisely said that those who do not learn from the past are condemned to repeat it, right? The question I want to pose to you, is it possible that in a time of real crisis, when the country feels imperiled, that America could be tempted to throw away at least some of our liberties? Could that happen? Well, let's look to the past and see if it's happened before. I'm a lawyer, and so when I have to research an issue, what I do is I go to the past. I say, when has this kind of factual thing happened before? What law applied to it? What did the courts do with it? Then I can advise a client as to the probable outcome. That's what I did with this. I went into America's past looking to see what happened when the country felt in a pinch, in a bind, when it felt imperiled. And guess what? Went back to 1861. Along about, well, just, I mean, right 2 weeks after the attack on Fort Sumter. You know what Abe Lincoln did? Sent a messenger up to Winfield Scott, who was a general then in command of the U.S. Army. He was up at Fort McHenry, where the Star-Spangled Banner was written. He said, "General, there's two things I have to say to you. Number one, if you have to, turn your cannon on the people, good people of Baltimore." Why? Because Baltimore was just full of Southern sympathizers. When Lincoln was on his way from the Middle West to his inauguration in Washington, he got to Baltimore. They had to hustle him off his train, take him in disguise in a carriage, move him several blocks across town to another train, and then have him go on to Washington. He might not have never gotten through Baltimore alive unless they had taken extraordinary measures. Very pro-Southern. Now think about it. Where's Washington, D.C. located? Right between Virginia and Maryland. You lose those two states and you can forget it. The ball game's over. So Lincoln is faced with a catastrophically important problem. The first thing he does, he says, if you need to shoot him, General. But number two, he says, I'm going to suspend the writ of habeas corpus. Now what's habeas? Let's talk about that for just a second. It's just the most powerful writ in the entire body of Anglo-Saxon and American law. It was granted by King John back in 1215. It became part of the Magna Carta, crossed the Atlantic, became a bedrock principle of American constitutional law. And what does it do? Basically, when you sue out requesting a writ of habeas corpus, you're asking a judge to even order the most powerful of U.S. agencies to turn you loose. If they have you in custody and a federal judge issues a writ of habeas corpus, they got to turn you loose. You're now in custody of the court. Very powerful. More powerful than our most powerful agencies. And Lincoln abolished the thing. Without habeas, the rest of the Bill of Rights, I'm thinking specifically the First, Second, Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, those lose their power. It's like a body. It's like a body without a skeleton. It's just a bunch of grizzle. It just doesn't stand up. Habeas corpus is the teeth in constitutional protection. Well, it gets abolished, and General Scott quickly went to work with that. There was in the city of Baltimore a guy by the name of John Merryman, and he was, for that era, what we would currently call a terrorist. He was a Southern sympathizer. He was organizing, we would call them cells today. They were Confederate training groups that were training to do paramilitary operations. And so he got to be well known to the pro-Union forces there. And one morning at 2 a.m., the soldiers knocked on his door, hustled him off at his nightshirt, put him in a stockade at Fort McHenry, closed the door, and lost the key. Hell without bail. Hell without charges being brought, hell without counsel, hell with nothing. Well, he finally got hold of an attorney able enough to bring a writ of habeas corpus. It was heard by, or an application for the writ, it was heard by Chief Justice Roger Taney, who issued the writ, said, turn the guy loose. He's in the custody now of the federal court. So the brave federal marshal rode his horse out to the gate of Fort McHenry trying to deliver this writ. He had on his belt a trusty Colt six-shooter. General Scott had the entire U.S. Army. Guess who won? And Merryman stayed in prison. Well, Congress responded to that by saying, President Lincoln, if you want any more powers, just name it, we'll give it to you. He said, I need various powers during the emergency to deal with it. They gave him even more than he asked for, and habeas corpus was basically suspended for the rest of the Civil War. Well, about 1864, there was another rascal out in the Middle West, up in Indiana, a guy by the name of Landon Milligan. And he was doing the same thing, just causing all kinds of trouble along the border states and trying to destroy the Union. Army picked him up, arrested him. He was tried by a military tribunal who promptly sentenced him to hang. His lawyer brought an application for writ of habeas corpus. It was heard by the Supreme Court. And here is what the Supreme Court said. Listen carefully. This nation has no right to expect it will always have wise and humane rulers. Wicked men, ambitious of power, may fill the place once occupied by Washington, and if this right to suspend privileges, provisions of the Constitution during great emergencies is conceded, the dangers to human liberty are frightful. Issued the writ, and it became part of black letter American constitutional law in re Milligan, ex parte Milligan, actually. All right. Now, the question I want to pose to you is this. It's very easy to see either side of this issue. To see constitutional rights disappear is always tragic and sad because it has cost too much blood to get them. Never throw away liberty because it's very, very precious. It cost a lot of people very dearly to get it. On the other hand, what does a great nation do when its survival is challenged? There is the balancing act. That's the challenge America is going to face more and more in the future. And it's very easy for us to sit in a kind of judgmental way and look at Washington, D.C. and you know, basically get down on everything and everybody up there. When in reality, I know a lot of people in the federal government, and there are an awful lot of wonderful people working there. They're good people. They do not mean ill. They don't mean to do any harm. They're trying their dead level best to make this country safe and to make it work right. And they're faced with challenges that are virtually without human solution. And these good people, meaning no harm, will probably, along with the majority of Americans, be the ones who at the end of time inadvertently back into decisions that will bring on a catastrophic collapse of liberty. So keep it in balance. It's very easy to get down on other people. But until you've sat in their desks and seen the challenges they face in dealing with things like terrorism, it's not easy to really correctly judge them. I just want to throw that caveat in. Well, anyway, 100 years went by. It was World War II. Some German saboteurs were landed on the shores of Long Island, 8 of them, ultimately. They had duffel bags full of explosives. They were, again, terrorists from their era, and their job was to go up and down the eastern seaboard, basically, and attack power plants and factories and just cause as much trouble as they could. Fortunately, as they came on the beach, as the German submarine growled away from the Long Island shore and left them there, the U.S. Coast Guard was on duty. They were arrested and put in jail. And Attorney General Biddle went to Franklin Roosevelt and he said, "Mr. President, we got a problem here. We've got the guys in custody, but there's not much we can charge them with. The only thing I've been able to come up with is conspiracy. And the prison sentence for that's rather minimal. So they never got to blow anything up and there's not much we can charge them with." Roosevelt said, we'll see about that. And he promptly convened a military tribunal, remanded all 8 of them to the military tribunal. They were assigned a military officer as their defense counsel. I don't know who the guy had made mad in his career, but obviously somebody, or he wouldn't have gotten the job. The guy was no slouch as a lawyer. He did his homework, and he dug up from the Civil War era this case of ex parte Milligan. And he took it all the way to the Supreme Court after they were found guilty by the tribunal and sentenced to be electrocuted. He went to the Supreme Court in a case that entered history as ex parte Quirin. And he said to the justices, "This very court in 1866 said the following: the Constitution is a law for rulers and people, equally in war and peace, and covers with the shield of its protection all classes of men, at all times, and under all circumstances." After saying that, you probably would say, "I rest my case," because that's about all you have to say. The Supreme Court didn't buy it. Their response was, "Well, things are different now. These guys were in civilian clothes, among other things." Of course, so was Lambdin Milligan. They affirmed the conviction, and 6 of the 8 were sentenced to be electrocuted within 1 hour of the same day. They just ran them right through the electric chair one after another. By the time number 6 sat down, the thing must have been warm. All of them were executed. Same thing happened immediately after World War II. By 1950, we're getting to be worried about communist conspiracy within this country. Very few people recognize it or remember it today, but there was a bill passed called the Emergency Detention Act of 1950. And it provided, let me read it to you from the language of the bill, provided that the Attorney General would be empowered to arrest and detain anyone for whom there's a reasonable ground to believe they will engage in acts of espionage or sabotage. So, if the President determined that there was an internal security emergency, that at that point, the Attorney General could arrest anybody he wanted to, hold them without jury, without bail, without confrontation of their accusers, and for an indefinite period of time. Any of this stuff sound familiar? Yeah. But the point I'm making is we've been there before. In pursuance of this particular act, there were 6 prison camps constructed around the country to hold potentially large numbers of people they rounded up. Now, I want to stop here and just give a caveat of concern. It's very, very easy for us to get very suspicious of government. There's a lot of conspiracy theory literature out there. I want to urge Adventists that we be very, very careful before taking too hyperbolic a view of this kind of thing. Reality in the time of trouble will be tough enough. We don't need to create one out of fantasy ahead of time. And the chances are that anything we create will be far less imaginative than what Lucifer comes up with when we actually face the problem. So I'm begging us, as we deal with some of these issues, to remember that while we have problems in this country, it is still, at this stage of the game, the best place on God's green earth. I've been overseas many times. It always feels good to come home. So we make mistakes. We have made them in the past here. We'll make them in the future. But I want to just add a bit of caution about reading too much conspiracy theory literature, most of which has very little in it that really goes to an original source I would want to take to court. This is an exception, and the reason I say this is I've heard all kinds of stories about, you know, prison camps being constructed all over the U.S. and they're sitting there now waiting for us. I know of no such schema in the current federal system, and I think it's just well for us to remember that as we address end time issues, it's important to be balanced. And as long as we can, we need to be good citizens. You know, what are we enjoined to do? Pray for our leaders. We ought to be doing that as much as we can. So anyway, back in that era, in the 1950s, prison camps, the detention camps were established. Thank the Lord, they were never needed or used. But in a time of perceived emergency, what happens? We at least consider and toy with the idea of depressing the level of personal liberty. Real quickly, the same thing happened over in Hawaii. Right after World War II began for us and Pearl Harbor had been attacked, obviously, everybody was in a state of emergency. They shut down the civil courts. They imposed martial law. Everything there was handled by military tribunals after Pearl Harbor. Well, after the Midway attack, in which the Japanese were so soundly defeated and began to retreat, it became obvious that Hawaii was no longer in danger. So the local federal judge there said, look, let's get our civil courts back in operation again. Let's cut out these military tribunals. Let's get the civil justice system working. Well, the general in charge wasn't interested in that. Finally, the judge got his back up, and he sent him some kind of threatening letter, said, if you don't implement a return of the civil courts, I'm going to find you in contempt. I'm going to find you in contempt of court, general. The general replied, if I hear anything more from you, Buster, I'm going to court-martial you. Now, guess who won that one? For the duration of World War II, Hawaii continued to be in a state of emergency. Civil courts were not operated. Military tribunals handled everything. And by the time the Supreme Court finally decided at the end of World War II the civil court should have been in session, what had happened? Several thousand man days of illegal, unlawful detention had been served by people. And of course, we all know about our Japanese-American friends. Right after Pearl Harbor, there was a lot of hysteria. Even Earl Warren, who was then governor of California, said, you know, you can't trust them. And I know they haven't done anything yet, but that's just proof. That's just proof of my theory. They're lying load of fool us. You know? Well, with reasoning like that, who can argue? And so was promulgated Executive Order 9066, which did what? Sent 109,600 some loyal Japanese Americans to what were basically prison camps. And I said in the earlier sessions this morning that when I went to grade school, a Japanese-American girl there with a last, very unfortunate last name of Yamamoto was born on the train going to one of those prison camps. So, in times of crisis, a country does indeed at least toy with the idea of abridging liberty. All right. Now let's bring ourselves to the present, see if we're facing a situation in which that might happen again. Let's go back to Bassam Tibi's statement. He's the professor at Harvard who's the Islamic fundamentalist expert. In And here's what he said one more time. The goal of the Islamic fundamentalist is to abolish the Western secular world order and replace it with a new imperial absolute Islamic world power. That's the issue we're facing. And we're facing it from people fully prepared to give their lives as the terminal guidance system for an explosive device. Pretty tough enemy to face. Professor Huntington at Harvard put it this way. I just want to give you an idea of the magnitude of the challenge that our country faces. Professor Huntington put it this way. Islam is the only power that has challenged the West for its survival, and it has done that at least twice. You realize Islam went right to the gates of Vienna, occupied Spain, and for a time threatened France? Twice, Islam has challenged the West. That's the dimension of the problem we face. All right, now let's talk about how we deal with it. As we approach these problems, just think of yourself as a federal officer or as a member of Congress trying to do your best to, you know, to keep America safe and secure. Ask yourself how you would deal with a challenge like that. Well, how do you? Number one, you've got to know who the terrorists are and where they are and what they're doing and where they've been and what weapons they have. Got to know all that. But you know something? Finding it out ain't always easy, is it? Because they've learned to fly under the radar. You know, we're equipped to fight a high-tech enemy like the old Soviet Union, not people who live in caves and send their messages handwritten with a guy on the back of a donkey. We just aren't equipped to find those kind of people. Furthermore, we have, most of us, no skill at all in Arabic. The language itself is highly complex, very, very hard to learn, almost impossible, I think, if you don't take it up as a kid. And the culture is very alien. We have pitifully few people in our major intelligence agencies can even handle Arabic. I know somebody working with the CIA, and he told me everybody in the office was, you know, doing a crash course and trying to learn a little elementary Arabic. They're at Langley, Virginia. We're also very, very ignorant of their culture, as has been so ably illustrated in Iraq. We don't understand the culture. We don't know what drives these folk. So finding out what they're going to do is a real challenge, isn't it? Well, how would you find out? What's one good way of finding out what the terrorist cells are doing? Well, you reach out and touch somebody, don't you? Get your hands on one if you can. Bring him in and wring the information out of him. But what if he ain't talking? Now imagine you're a federal officer. You have somebody in the interrogation room under security that will not even admit the possibility of his escape. On his person, you have discovered documents that show very clearly there will be another 9/11 and it's going to happen tomorrow. And thousands of Americans are going to die. The only problem is you don't know where. The location isn't specified and you don't know what they're going to do. But you know it's coming. And you try every approach you can in interrogating him. First you try to be nice and reasonable. Then you call in the bad cop and he works him over for a while, verbally. And in response to every question, he just sneers at you, this detainee, and says, "Allahu Akbar, God is great." An hour goes by. Now it's 23 hours till another September 11. And you call in everybody in the office that knows anything about interrogating prisoners. But you see, you got this problem called the Constitution. And a provision in the Bill of Rights called cruel and unusual punishment. And now it's 22 hours. And if you can get him to talk, you can save thousands. And at this point, what are you tempted to do? Well, you're tempted to do what Alan Dershowitz would do. In his book called Shouting Fire, he says it's time to institutionalize torture. Let's get it on the books. Let's make it legal. Let's set up clear legal processes by which we do it. You go to a federal judge. Say, "Judge, I got this guy in custody. It's obvious he knows where the next 9/11 is going to be. He isn't talking. We're requesting the judicial authorization to use torture." And he says, "We don't want to be inhumane about this. We're a sanitary, humane country. You sterilize the needles first. You don't want to introduce infection. Then you put them under his fingernails." I heard him say it on a television talk show. And I bought his book, and here's what he says in his book. You want to apply a cost-benefit analysis. The life of one guilty terrorist is surely worth less than the lives of hundreds of innocent citizens. Torture. Now, may I suggest that America has reached a very serious challenge if we are prepared to consider using something we have never officially sanctioned before. And I understand there are news stories out there now of privately funded, shall we say, government-funded aircraft that fly people around the world to more convenient venues. This kind of stuff may go on. But here in America, you know, the Constitution would seem to prohibit that. Now we're at a point where we're willing to consider the possibility of doing the very thing that all through the course of our constitutional history we have not wanted to do. Number two, in addition to wringing the information out of an individual, if you're lucky enough to catch one, you're going to have to intrude into privacy. You've got to. Why? Think about it. The 9/11 hijackers came here. They made their plans. They rented apartments. They bought weapons. They came into airport secure areas. All of which was made possible. Why? Because of something called the Fourth Amendment. Now, what does the Fourth Amendment say? The right of the people to be secure in their papers, persons, houses, and effects against unreasonable search and seizure shall not be violated. The right to privacy. Privacy is one of the most precious of all our personal rights, isn't it? Just the right to feel that you can have a part of yourself nobody has any way of intruding into. Not to be stared at in the privacy of your own home. That's, you know, why we have drapes, isn't it? That reminds me of the case I read a number of years ago about somebody was down south here in one of these southern states, I'm sorry to say. Kind of a creepy gentleman. He had a duplex. He rented the other side to a young married couple. They had been there several months before they realized that one of the mirrors in their bathroom was two-way. And the guy had been watching them from the other side. Well, he was prosecuted, you know, quite justifiably. I think there was a civil suit that ensued also for invasion of privacy. But privacy is very important to us. Until it's violated, you know, you don't have a realization of just how precious it is. You have the right not to have your conversations monitored, to have your mail secure, not to have your financial records disclosed without your permission, right? But think about it. In 50 U.S. Code, sections 1801 and following, there is a provision entitled the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. And that thing has been amended since terrorism became an issue to allow the FBI to secretly conduct a physical search or a wiretap to obtain evidence of a crime. But what has changed now is they no longer have to prove probable cause of a crime. They go to a federal judge or federal magistrate. They simply say, Your Honor, we are seeking records for a foreign intelligence investigation, and on that assertion alone, the judge is required to issue the warrant. No presentation of evidence whatever. Now, some of these warrants allow them to enter a building or, you know, office or place of residence without ever having alerted the individual that they're looking. They go in, they're very good at it. This is open source information. They'll take Polaroids of where everything is on the desk so they can put it back where it was. Then they go through it, and when they're done, everything goes back. You come home, you got no idea anybody was in the house. And all of this can be done basically under a very accelerated protocol where a federal judge is required. It's called a shall issue warrant. What about the privilege of a lawyer and a client to talk in confidence? Just imagine, I'm in custody. I've been charged by the Department of Justice with a crime. I need you bad. You're my lawyer. You come in there. And we start talking about the facts and issues of my case. How would you feel as a lawyer if you knew the room was wired? And the very attorneys who would be bringing the case against me were listening to everything we said. I cannot conceive of a more chilling effect on justice than to have that happen. And yet, that was, again, part of recent legislation What happened was that under what was called emergency authority, the Department of Justice promulgated a regulation allowing them to eavesdrop on confidential attorney-client conversations if there was reasonable suspicion that the prisoner might use communications with the lawyer to get information out to terrorists. Now, before we gasp and wring our hands too much, that's exactly what has happened, isn't it? You've been watching the news, haven't you? At least one lawyer was indeed carrying information out to terrorists and is now being charged with a crime. See, these end-time issues aren't simple. Very, very easy for us to sit in judgment on a government that is facing real issues, real serious challenges, to which there is no good human solution. The more I think about it, the more I think of a corner. We're being pushed further and further into a corner, and you get into the corner, you discover there's no door, and the only way out of this mess is straight up. That's called the second coming. We're into a terminally dangerous world. All right. So, when you strip away privacy, and that's what we're in the process of doing because we have to know what the terrorists are doing, what happens is that you get almost literally naked. I mean, in Orlando, Florida, you get virtually naked if you go through a certain X-ray machine in the airport. Are you aware of that? I mean, the problem is that not every weapon a person might carry would necessarily show up on the magnetometer. And if it's on their person and it isn't magnetic and it does not produce some sort of magnetic signal, you could get in with it, as has been seen with some explosives. So if they've got a person that they think is a high-risk person, they want to specially evaluate, they can walk you through this thing. It's gender-specific. If you're a guy, there's a guy looking at the X-ray machine, and with women, vice versa. But when you walk through, the thing has a wavelength such it easily penetrates clothing, but it doesn't penetrate skin. Which means what? What does it mean? Well, I asked that question at a meeting out west, and there was a little kid out in the audience there, about 10 years old, and he pipes up in his pipe and voice, "They could see your privates real good." Not many people are comfortable with that. But is there a possibility that in time of crisis, Americans might be willing to throw away something as precious as the Fourth Amendment right to privacy? Well, let me read you a letter to the editor of Time magazine that came in right after the 11th of September. It was a sad time for all of us. I love this country, and I look back on that time, and it still hurts to see my country hurting, see fellow Americans hurting. But this fellow right after that wrote a letter that went like this. When the Constitution was drafted, we did not have dirty bombs, suitcase atomic weapons, computers, or easy worldwide travel. Give me security and take some of my privacy, please. And he adds the word please. Well, he can be accommodated, can't he? All he has to do is go to Orlando. All right. We've talked about torture. We've talked about invasion of privacy. What else? What about profiling? From a law enforcement perspective, it can be argued that it makes perfect sense. After all 19 were from an identifiable racial group and religious group. And the argument would go, if you're going to look for a threat, look in the direction of the threat sector. Don't bug grandma over here with her two grandchildren coming through. Look at the people that are apt to be attacking the country. All of that sounds persuasive and perhaps has some persuasive effect in terms of just law enforcement. Well, what does it do to the dignity and rights of individuals? What's the result? If you were to profile Islam, what would it look like? Well, for one thing, the Islamic believer has a unique day of worship, don't they? I wrote that up there on the board. Kind of give me a jump start on what the rest of the work I have to do. They don't go to church on Sunday like most people do here. They got to have a different day. They go on Friday. So they have a unique day of worship. That's part of their profile. Well, wait a minute. So do we. The Islamic believer also believes that he or she has a prophet. But so do we, don't we? You kind of got to ask anymore, don't you? There are churches I speak at now, and I always say, can I mention the spirit of prophecy here? It's kind of sad we're getting to that state. There's another profile very similar. They've also got something else called a health message. Very similar to ours, not nearly as sophisticated as ours. Why? Because the Lord gave an end-time church additional information augmenting and amplifying on the existing good biblical principles. Because why? At the end of time, as human wickedness and greed increases, disease is going to increase in animals. Ever heard of mad cow? But once again, if you look at the Islamic profile, it is fascinatingly similar to ours, isn't it? But that's not all. They also have a dress reform code. It's a little bit extreme. I've often felt sorry for gals in burqas, particularly down in Florida, you know, on a hot summer day. But they have dress reform. And you know something? So did we once. One of their real beefs with America is the junk we produce in Hollywood. They have a concern about the stuff you take into your mind, entertainment. And so did we once. Brothers and sisters, we don't get a handle on this, we are going to lose our kids. And we're going to lose ourselves. You watch that stuff long enough and pretty soon it becomes a part of you. You don't have to think about it. It's just the process of osmosis. The Islamic believer strongly believes in the day of judgment. They're preoccupied with it, heavily preoccupied. But so are we, or should be. Because that right there is the unique contribution Adventism has made to Christian theology. Now, I'm well aware out where I come from in California, there are people with some degrees after their names that say it's time we ought to outgrow this thing because it puts us out of step with the Christian majority. And they'll sometimes add it isn't biblical either. Well, I got news for them. It is biblical. And there are some very fine scholars in our midst who have done some very, very good pieces on this. I think of Mervyn Maxwell, for example, a giant of a man. I miss him so. He was such a fine scholar and theologian. Did a wonderful book. If you can get a hold of it, get a hold of Mervyn Maxwell's book, Magnificent Disappointment. Tells all about 1844 and gives a scholarly understanding of how he came to understand the judgment. You know, people, Christians, this is one of the reasons why many of our evangelical fellow Christians are very prejudiced against Adventists. Not just because of the Sabbath, but we have challenged them with the concept the day of judgment has begun. And they're scared to death of it. Judgment, you know, as if it were something to fear. And they never realize that if you really think it through, the judgment is the most wonderful thing can happen to you. Why? Because your judge is also your redeemer. Isn't he? For the Father judges no man, but have committed all judgment unto whom? Unto the Son. That's pretty good news, but it gets even better. Not only is your redeemer your judge, he's also your defense attorney. Huh? My little children, these things I write that you sin not, but if any man sin, we have an advocate. Now, you fuse those two offices in one. You put together judge and defense attorney. How are you going to lose the case? People say, I want full assurance. Adventists say, you're robbing us of our full assurance with a judgment. We'll go back and read the book again. You don't get better full assurance than to have your judge be your defense attorney. How do you lose it? Well, you can. You can lose it by firing your defense lawyer. A lot of people do, but that's how you lose the case. So anyway, the point I'm making here is there's one more I want to put up here. Rocks and mountains. God's people know at the very end when the world becomes terminally dangerous and there's no human safety left here. God's people are going to have to rely on the kind earth, aren't they? But guess who got there first? Al-Qaeda. Look at that profile. Now, transport yourself in imagination into a troubled future in which your neighbors are frightened. Bad things have happened to America. I can easily envision a future in which airliners start getting shot down with shoulder-fired missiles. I don't know why it hasn't happened yet. I can envision dirty bombs. I can envision some of those missing chimodan, those Russian suitcase nukes. Heaven forbid they get their hands on them. We'll see parts of cities disappear. You get in a troubled future like that. And they decide it is time to do profiling. You imagine the average frightened person seeing those profiles superficially similar is going to have the ability to make that discriminating judgment. We could easily be mistaken for the enemy. Well, time-wise, how are we going here? I want to hurry on ahead. we do this kind of thing. We start profiling too much seriously. And the risk we run is we begin to become suspicious of each other, isn't it? You know, society breaks down not so much from gigantic events happening at the top as it does from the glue of human society just dissolving on the individual level. We become suspicious of each other. We no longer really have a country, do we? We have isolated individuals looking at each other with a jaundiced eye. And I think of that time when a Russian pastor, right after the Soviet Union broke up, came over to America with his family, and my wife and I wanted to send some books back to the school there in Moscow. So one evening, he pulled his rental car up behind our car, and we were transferring boxes of books from our trunk to his trunk, and he was getting more and more nervous. I didn't know what was bugging him. It was obvious he was not a happy camper. Finally, he had to say it. He said, "Won't the neighbors be angry?" I said, "About what?" "Well, what we're doing here. They're watching, aren't they?" And it suddenly hit me, in the old Soviet Union, if you were out on the street transferring boxes of books, you would be suspect, wouldn't you? And on every block, they had a member of the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution. They have it in Cuba, too. Comité para Defensa de la Revolución. Somebody on every block is watching the houses. You buy a refrigerator, for example. Move it into your house. It's noted. Somebody there notes it. It's made a record of in Havana. And as has happened to Cubans wanting to emigrate, if they get permission to emigrate, the list of their possessions is brought. And they said, "You got to account for this refrigerator and that stove and the new bicycle. Turn them into Fidel before you walk out of that country penniless." Okay? Simply because people are now watching each other. Now, the reason I bring this up is that about a year, year and a half ago, there was a suggestion made and then kind of quickly retracted because politically it wasn't the most saleable thing. But somebody in government said, "Look, one of our first lines of defense is the individual." And he's right. Nobody knows your neighborhood as well as you do. You have an innate sense of what really is normal there and what isn't normal. If somebody strange comes around or something strange happens, you can sense it quicker than any cop could who doesn't know the block. So the suggestion was made, you know, that we watch our neighbors and we watch our neighborhoods, and if anything weird is going on, turn it in. Which, from a law enforcement perspective, does make a modicum of sense, doesn't it? All of these suggestions make sense in terms of internal security, but would you really want to live in a neighborhood like that? There's the challenge you face. Now, the concern that I feel is that I think we are rapidly surrendering constitutional rights. Some of them, like the Fourth Amendment, we've just given up half voluntarily. Those credit cards we carried are now married up to computer technology. You know, when the receipt comes out, it's got your name on it, a list of everything you bought and how much you paid, where and when, doesn't it? Have you seen those receipts? Have you ever wondered if the same computer that generated that paper might just choose to remember who you were and what you bought? And if you've chosen to wonder about that, you'll understand why it is that you get these blizzards of advertising in the mail. There's now a growth industry of data mining, and they, from your purchases, from the things you do and where you go, they can pretty well tell your probable age, your probable income, your address, your hobbies. They probably can pretty well guess what illnesses you've got. And think further from that same extrapolated data. The Internal Revenue Service can easily construct your probable income, and do. So when you do your 1040 this year, do it right. You ain't going to be able to hide much from them, so do it right. I mean, I guess I'm a tax lawyer, but I'm old-fashioned enough to think that there are certain moral duties we owe, and I do my best to pay an honest tax. I know the tax code reasonably well, and I try to pay an honest tax and do it right. Why? I think that's probably the least I owe my country. So what we've done is set up a protocol here in which we have voluntarily surrendered a whole lot of rights. Now enter the cell phone. That thing creates an electronic record of where you've been and who you talk to. You can track a person's meanderings by just getting their cell phone bill. Easy. That's how we followed some terrorists, along with reconstruction of charge card usages. And the newest cell phones with a GPS can track you to within 50 feet. Now, what's the matter with all of this? Well, beyond personal embarrassment or inconvenience, probably nothing. I don't see a moral issue to this particularly, but the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, see, are like a chain. They're links linked together. You cut one of those links, and what happens to the Bill of Rights? It comes apart. Now, here's the point that I really am concerned about. For generations, we as Adventists have known that there will be a religious liberty issue at the end of time, and we've focused on that. Our threat sector has been the First Amendment. We have expected, basically, the Pope or Pat Robertson or somebody to come riding down Main Street, you know, in a grand parade assaulting the First Amendment. And I think we've kind of waited in smug confidence, you know, that when the time of trouble comes, we'd recognize it. After all, it's going to be a Sunday law, right? We've underestimated the enemy. Lucifer is not that stupid. While we were all doing this, looking at the First Amendment, we missed the fact that Lucifer was first eviscerating the Fourth, the right to privacy. This one hasn't been seriously abridged yet, although it could happen very easily, and Sunday laws are on the books of many states, albeit unenforced. And since the Crown Kosher Market case up in 1960 or 61, Sunday laws have been held to be constitutional in many instances. Well, we've been looking at the First Amendment, not realizing the Bill of Rights is an organic whole, and the real threat sector has been stuff like the Fourth Amendment, not to mention emerging into an era of terrorism, amendments covering things like right to counsel, cruel and unusual punishment, speedy trials. There's where the threat sector is right now. Once this chain breaks, the principle has been established that in a time of national emergency, if you can do that, you can also do that. If you can take away Amendment 4, you can take away Amendment 1 or part of it. Having mentioned that, let me close by quickly raising some concerns I do feel about the First Amendment. Let's go back real quickly through what's happened since I was a law student. When I was a law student, we had cases like Sherbert versus Verner, in which an Adventist lady had been fired ostensibly for cause because she wouldn't work on Sabbath. Okay? She went, applied for unemployment compensation, was denied because she was fired for cause, took it all the way to the Supreme. Supreme Court enunciated the principle that there has to be an overwhelming threshold of need before the federal government can allow the imposition of a law that infringes on your free exercise of religion. It was a free exercise clause issue. Well, constitutional lawyers from that point on became rather comfortable in their confidence that the wall of separation and the Sherbert test and the Lemon test and all the other black letter tests we relied on were safe and secure. There was a clear wall of separation between church and state, and the First Amendment was secure. And then along came the Smith case. You're all well aware of it. You're clear of the facts. Remember those two Native American guys, Alfred Smith and Galen Black? They were drug rehabilitation counselors, for Pete's sake. They went out one weekend to do a Native American religious retreat. Part of their ethic was that they had to see visions. Visions don't always come easy. Sometimes you got to jump start them. So they did peyote. When in Monday morning, the boss said, "It's your turn, guys. Let's have the sample." And, of course, the sample disclosed the hallucinogenic drug. They were fired. They went down, tried to get unemployment compensation. The state of Oregon said, "Just get out and stay out. You were fired for cause." Found a lawyer. The lawyer said, "You got a slam dunk, guys, because of Sherbert versus Verner." There was an Advent lady. And she won. It's the same principle. He went all the way to the Supremes. And then the boot dropped. Boot number one. Court said, "We can no longer afford the luxury of this kind of presumption that we need to protect every religious act." Thing was turned on its ear. Now the standards began to relax as to what would in fact offend First Amendment rights. Religious Freedom Restoration Act came along. That was overturned in Bernie versus Flores down in Texas. Supreme Court sent us back to square one. We're still on square one. We don't know where this thing is going. But in a sense, I think I do know where it's going. Not too long ago, Cardinal Bevilacqua in the Philadelphia Archdiocese said this: "If we can get a private school voucher plan through in one state, that's the foot in the door. I want to see it passed. I want it to go through the courts to remove the separation of church and state." Well, the next boot to drop was Zelman, the Zelman case, in which school vouchers were held to be constitutional. And I hate to say it, but I will, because I'm a layman, there are no career implications for me when I say what I have to say. One of our Adventist colleges helped that thing along by suing to get state money and alleging as part of their pleadings that they were not pervasively sectarian. Well, if they aren't, what they doing there? That's one issue. That's an internal theological issue, I guess. But in that case, and I won't say the case name, I don't mean to necessarily focus on an institution. Bless his heart, Clarence Thomas jumped at the chance to address an issue that would further erode the wall of separation between church and state. Clarence Thomas is a brilliant jurist, probably one of the smartest ones on the court. He said, look, they raised the argument that they're not pervasively sectarian. I want to suggest that the pervasively sectarian test itself ought to be abolished, and we just frankly and openly give federal money for worthy causes to institutions that are pervasively sectarian. He would eviscerate the whole thing. That should have given us warning. The Zelman case was a vouchers case, but the one that really concerns me is Elk Grove Unified School District versus Newdow. I've got the advance sheets here. I never bothered to copy them out of the bound reporter, so I don't have a page site. I can't give you a pinpoint site. I'll give you the volume of 542 U.S. You want to look it up for yourself, look it up. It's Elk Grove versus Newdow. This is the one that dealt with the flag salute issue, you know, the individual claiming that because under God is in the flag salute, it was an offense. The court found that it wasn't. But Justice Thomas did one of his famous concurring opinions in that case. He tosses these things in every once in a while. They're perhaps dicta, but they give you an idea where the man's coming from. And he came up with a unique idea that the court had made the right decision for the wrong reasons. Let me explain something to you about how the Bill of Rights gets applied to individuals. Bill of Rights, as it guarantees individual rights, has to be made applicable to the state through the 14th Amendment. That's basic black-letter constitutional law. It's called the Incorporation Doctrine. If a particular portion of the Bill of Rights is deemed to be incorporated in the 14th Amendment, it flows through and protects the individual against state action. By the way, the Second Amendment has not been incorporated. That's one of the issues now in gun rights legislation as to whether or not it really confers a right on the individual. And I'll divert for just a second here and say that that is what helped to disenfranchise black America in the era of Jim Crow. Real quick reprise of that case. There were a group of African-American guys going to vote after the Civil War. They were, I think, in Texas. And they had a firearm, as indeed you would expect they might want to have in that era. And along came this mob of whites, heavily armed. They disarmed the blacks. The blacks brought an action for infringement of civil rights based on their Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. You know what the Supreme Court did with that? They said the Second Amendment is not incorporated through the 14th to state action. Therefore, if a state takes your arms away, there's nothing the federal government can do. To which we then saw the follow-on Jim Crow legislation, that era, and all the way through Plessy versus Ferguson, when a black man buys a train ticket and can't ride in the coach he paid for. And it took us 55 to 60 years of hard judicial work to get that constitutional mess straightened out in Brown versus Board of Education. So the incorporation doctrine is not esoteric legal theory. This thing bites, and it can bite you bad. Now, Justice Thomas, ironically, has said that part of the First Amendment does not enjoy the incorporation doctrine, therefore cannot protect you from state action. And here's what it looks like. Here's just a classic schema of the First Amendment. You have the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. Justice Thomas says the Free Exercise Clause is obviously designed to protect the individual, so it flows through and does so. In other words, the government cannot do things that will prohibit your free exercise of religion, although after the Smith case, that's a little bit of empty rhetoric. But as to the Establishment Clause, he says that thing doesn't reach the individual, and here is why. It is not designed to confer an individual right. It is designed to confer a right on the state to establish a state religion. Let me read it to you from his opinion. Here it is. Elk Grove versus Newdow. Justice Thomas speaking, concurring opinion. I accept that the Free Exercise Clause, which clearly protects an individual right, applies against the states through the 14th Amendment. But the Establishment Clause is another matter. The text and history of the Establishment Clause strongly suggest that it is a federalism provision intended to prevent Congress from interfering with state establishments. Translate that into ordinary language, and what does it mean? The only thing I can figure out it means is that the state of Utah could establish the LDS Church as the official state church of the state. Justice Thomas says the Establishment Clause does not purport to protect individual rights. I haven't heard this even commented on. I haven't heard anybody say anything about this. We've talked about the flag salute issue. We've talked about Zelman. We've talked about other stuff. But buried in this thing as dicta, but as a potent indicator of where Thomas would go and maybe some of his other justices on the court, is a threat of monumental proportions to the Bill of Rights. Now he closes his opinion with this. I would welcome the opportunity to consider more fully the difficult questions whether and how the Establishment Clause applies against the states. What's he saying? Wink, wink. Bring it on, boys. Bring me a case. Now, the composition of the Supreme Court probably will change during the next 4 years. We know the Chief Justice is quite ill. I personally know from just personal contacts, personal friends, and I'm not going to identify the justice because it would be a breach of their privacy. I know another justice that is not well. We could see in the next 4 years 5-4 decisions turning upside down. They could go 6-3. And the whole ball game could seriously change. Can it happen? Could it happen here? I think it's time to wake up, because it's happened elsewhere. At 4 o'clock on the morning of October 16, 1970, Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau proclaimed the existence of a state of apprehended insurrection in Canada. There was some thought that the Quebec Liberation Front would kidnap a British consul and some senior Canadian officials. He proclaimed a state of insurrection. 450 people were arrested, never charged. They were detained incommunicado. The Canadian Bill of Rights was suspended. Short time later, 1970, in Ireland, in the middle of the night, Irish Prime Minister Lynch announced a grave emergency. The splinter group of the IRA was conspiring to kidnap prominent ministers. He empowered the police to intern any citizen without trial and the places of preparation be prepared immediately. 10 days later, in the wake of kidnapping and demonstrations in Spain, Francisco Franco granted emergency powers to the Spanish police to detain people up to 6 months. They suspended the nation's Bill of Rights. It can, and it does, happen in major Western countries. Where does that leave us? Leads us right back to the Word of God, doesn't it? All this could be terribly depressing if we didn't know how the story ends. And that's what I'm going to address in my presentation in the next hour, that I will entitle In the Eye of the Storm. Thanks for being here and listening. Let's close with prayer. Dear Lord, we thank you for this church and for this country. We've talked about hard issues today, but we talk about them with respect because we know that an awful lot of well-meaning people are working hard, doing their best to try to prevent problems. And we know that unless we're in the Word of God, it's so easy to make a mistake in doing that, inadvertently trample on liberties that are very precious. And we pray that you will enable us to be helpful in our country, not critical of our country, but helpful in every way we can, in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International Copyright 2005, all rights reserved. To order additional CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, call our toll-free order line, 1-800-233-4450. For international calls, dial 717-652-7000. You may also download our latest catalog or order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your letters and ongoing financial support are greatly appreciated. This year, 2005, we are celebrating our 30th anniversary, 30 years of faithfully maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It is an orchestra. Speakers associated with this ministry are all on the same page. There is no theological compromise here at ACM. We're helping prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.